The Boston Faith and Justice Network is a community of Christians committed to justice as an expression of our faith. And our mission is to alleviate poverty and promote just stewardship through lifestyle, community, and policy change. And a bit of background, we came to this through a series of house meetings and church gatherings that a whole range of Christians in the Boston area participated in, starting in 2006, to arrive at both this mission and then the work around environmental justice that we'll talk about in a bit.
My name is Lisa Sharon Harper, and I'm actually going to talk with you just a quick bit about the mission of New York Faith and Justice. If any of you were in our earlier seminar about uniting faith and justice, then you heard a lot about that. So I won't go too deeply into it, except to say that our mission statement is following Christ, uniting the church, ending poverty in New York through spiritual formation, education, and direct advocacy. And so when we are looking at how do we do that, what is it that we're seeking to do? New York Faith and Justice seeks to bridge faith communities and environmental justice organizations through collaborative action that addresses unjust environmental policy. And Boston Faith and Justice Network, she'll explain a little more.
Just to say, kind of the core ways that we've done environmental justice work is first through small group support for living simply and more justly, and then by building community-wide support for fair trade.
So with New York Faith and Justice, I want to take a step back and ask the question, first, what do we mean by environmental justice? What's the difference between environmental justice and environmentalism? There is a very real difference. And the environmental movement was one that was started at the turn, right around the 1920s, 1930s, with the Parks Projects. In the U.S., trying to salvage the parks. Now, if you look back at the history of that time in that era, the people using the parks were generally white folks in America, and people who were not white were generally not really allowed to use the parks. If they were, they were segregated to a small area. So the Parks Projects were really a project, or the environmental movement was begun as really a movement by white people for white people. That's why when you go into communities of color and you say you're an environmentalist, they think, oh, it's not for us. But what happened was right around the 1970s, 1980s, there began to be an acute awareness that in urban and rural black poor areas, and black and just people of color areas, there was a high amount of dumping going on, toxic dumping. And in fact, there's a wonderful study called Race and Toxic Waste in America. It was done by the UCC Church, United Church of Christ. And it's absolutely awesome. You can Google it online and find out more information about it. Toxic Waste and Race, that's the name of the paper. What they found was that if you were to look at all of the different toxic sites in America and put them on a map, put dots all over the map, and then overlay on top of that map all of the most black and brown areas in America, there would be a one-to-one correlation. One-to-one. So the Toxic Waste and Race report really kind of catalyzed a movement. And that movement began in these communities of color. And that movement became known as the environmental justice movement. So the environmental justice movement is one that intrinsically, actually, is for people of color and by people of color. But there's something very special happening right now, and I think it has to do with this grassroots movement that's happening among churches and people of faith around the country who are beginning to join ranks with, in partnership with these communities of color, to fight on behalf of and in partnership with them to clean up the toxic waste and to make sure that these environments are more healthy. So there's a broadening of the constituency of environmental justice groups. So in short, we're building bridges by faith to love, protect, and respect our human neighbor, to steward and protect the environment. So there's overlap there. Now, What we found in New York Faith and Justice that was that in order for us to move forward in this, especially if we're really going to try to organize faith communities, we really had to understand what's the theological underpinning. Why do we care about this theologically? There are lots of other seminars that are really looking at this in depth, so we're not going to spend too much time on this today. But I wanted to give you an overview of why New York Faith and Justice felt like, okay, we need to engage in this as people of faith. We needed to first, in order to organize faith leaders, we need to deepen our theological understanding. We wanted to also put faith networks to work, and we wanted to collaborate with environmental justice advocates who can help lead the way. Now, what does it look like to make things right? Here's the theological underpinning. When we started laying down a theology for environmental justice, we started with those two words, environmental and justice. So environmental, everything that makes up our landscape, whether it's rural or urban. And justice really just simply biblically means to make things right. So environmentalism versus environmental justice, we just got the history of that. And now we need to just go into the shalom theology that really gives us our undergirding for what we're talking about. The concept of shalom is grounded in Genesis, Genesis 1 and 2. And in Genesis 1 and 2, we see that all of creation was created in relationship with each other, that there was nothing created outside of relationship. And on the end of the sixth day, God looked around that creation and said, "This is very good." Not just good, this is very good. Now, what did God mean when God said, "This is very good"? In the Hebraic worldview, very goodness was kind of the closest thing they had to perfection. And then when they thought of perfection, they were not thinking of the way that the Greeks would think of it, which would be no spot or blemish on the actual object. The way that they thought of perfection in their worldview was that actually it had to do with the ties between things. That the ties between things were very good. They were strong. So that the relationships between all of the created things that God had made were very good. The relationship between humans and God, the relationship between men and women, the relationship between humans with their very selves, the relationship with humans and the systems that govern them, and the relationship between humans and the rest of creation was very good in Genesis 1. And so then we come and you get a very intimate picture of what that very goodness looked like in Genesis 2. It looks like tilling the soil. It looks like us actually exercising our dominion. And that word dominion in a really modern sense is really, I think, the closest word to it that we have right now is exercising agency, our ability to make choices that impact our environment. Right? So, and that's what it means in the text. Our dominion is directly tied to being made in the image of God. And so, in Genesis 2, what it looks like to exercise our dominion, to be fully in the image of God, is to make choices that bless our environment. We name the animals. We till the land, the soil. We cultivate the earth. We steward what God made. Now, what happened at the fall was that, you know, God gave us this choice that we had to make, the tree, ironically, a piece of the environment, another piece of creation, that there was a command attached to. And that command was, look, don't eat of this tree, because if you do, you're going to experience death. Well, we chose our own way to shalom, our own way to peace. We decided we were going to choose to trust ourselves, not God. And as we did that, we chose peace for me as opposed to peace for the upper all. And as a result, all of the relationships that were created in the very beginning were broken, shattered, crushed at the fall. And you see it. You see it one after another, they fall down, starting with our relationship with ourselves, then going to our relationship with God when we hide from God, then running to our relationship between men and women. We start blaming each other. And the next thing to go is our relationship with creation, with the rest of creation. First, with the sniping of the serpent at the heel of the woman, first time in the story of humanity that we see an animal sniping at a human being. And then secondly, when thorns and thistles come up out of the earth, instead of, you know, having a tree go, hey, I made you a mango today, or asparagus coming up and saying, hey, you want some asparagus? It's good for you. Now the relationship between us and the earth is one where we have to beat the earth to get anything out of it. Now, what I believe is that the ground is cursed. First of all, one thing to notice about this is that when you look at the text in Genesis 3, the word curse is never used in relationship to the humans. It is only used in relationship to the rest of creation. The serpent is cursed, and the ground is cursed. And I believe that they're cursed as a witness of the state of our relationship with God. Because as we have chosen our own way to peace, we have actually chosen out of God's way to peace. As we have chosen our own way to wholeness, we've chosen not to trust God's way to wholeness. Now, why is all this important? In Romans 8, 19 through 22, the scripture says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now." Now, what is that? What do those labor pains look like? Next slide. Looks like wars, looks like genocide, looks like exploitation, corruption, resource consumption, and ultimately has ended, or not ended, but is now progressing in an ever-escalating trip towards global warming, climate change. Now, wars and genocide, let me just go into that briefly. The wars and genocide, this is one little case study of what I'm talking about when I say wars and genocide. How is that connected to environment? That's kind of weird. Well, think about it. Almost every single major conflict you can name has been about resources. Almost every single one. Even Darfur, even Bosnia, which were named as ethnic conflicts. They are not fundamentally, they did not start as ethnic conflicts. They started as resource wars. In Darfur, Sudan, it began as a water war, a war over water rights between the herdsmen and the farmers in Sudan. And then Omar Gaddafi began to play this off of each other and play the different people groups within Sudan off of each other. And he's the one who began to spin it into an ethnic war between the Arabized and the Black Sudanese. And now you have genocide. You do have an ethnic conflict. It's become an ethnic conflict. Same thing in Bosnia. Same thing if you look pretty much anywhere. Even the Holocaust was originally about resources. So when we look around and we see these things, we can know there's actually been sin here in this place. We can know someone has chosen their own peace at the expense of the peace of others. Now, Faith Leaders for Environmental Justice is a group of faith leaders that kind of came out of a few conversations with a few different groups of advocates and churches and faith leaders in New York City. New York Faith and Justice was right there at the beginning, but we were not the only ones. And we began with breakfasts that just educated faith leaders, interfaith leaders around New York City about the issues, first of all, about what environmental justice is, and about the specific issues of environmental justice that were affecting particular neighborhoods, especially those Black and brown poor neighborhoods in New York City. We began in the South Bronx in January of 2008. And when we began with 30, we gathered 30 environmental justice leaders and faith leaders. And they shared their stories. And I'll never forget one story of Anna Vincente from Nos Queramos, which means we are still here. And she told the story just of a few months before that of holding in her arms the son of a friend who died on the emergency room table of asthma. Asthma. And then she said, this is a common thing in the South Bronx. Why? because thousands of garbage trucks make their way through New York City every day across 125th Street through Harlem up into the South Bronx because there are zero garbage treatment plants in New York City, in Manhattan, and there are 40 in the South Bronx. And so thousands make their way, and that makes the South Bronx the area of New York City that has the highest concentration, not even the area of New York City, forgive me, the area of the United States with the highest concentration of asthma cases. It's also the poorest congressional district in the country, so you have the least amount of health care provision. So death by asthma is common in the South Bronx. A few months later, we organized 60 faith leaders in Manhattan and shared the same things with them. We all told our stories. We gave them an education about what environmental justice is. We had four separate faith leaders from different faiths actually stand up and talk about why environmental justice matters to their faith. And then at the end, I asked the faith leaders, so do you think God is calling us to become something? Do you think God is calling us to do something? And it was the Pentecostal Latino pastor in the back who erupted in applause and said, finally, finally. And then a whole wave of applause kind of erupted around the room. And the thing about that gathering that was special was not that there were faith leaders in the room. If you know New York City, you know New York is a highly organized city. Justice has been being done in New York City for a very long time and by faith leaders. What was unique here was that we were there. Evangelicals were there in the mix. Why? I think it's because we're beginning to understand the theology of shalom and how that calls us to care about people and the environment. So Faith Leaders for Environmental Justice was established in September of 2008. Now we meet monthly. We have work collaboratively. And you'll see here, these are the list of the main groups at the core of our group. There are actually 150 faith leaders that are connected with Faith Leaders for Environmental Justice now. We have three working groups, and those working groups, we meet monthly over breakfast. I think I misspoke. The breakfasts happen quarterly. The working groups meet monthly. So environmental justice organizers and faith leaders and actually government representatives as well come together in working groups that are divided down into three working groups: food justice, climate justice, and toxic hazards. And we bring a diverse fellowship around common goals, leveraging economic and social capital for justice. So this is a picture of us at one of our meetings. Next picture. Last Christmas, we had them begin to plan and strategize for how they were going to have a green Christmas. That was one of our initiatives in December of last year. Over the last year, though, we've really been focused on an initiative called Fresh. It's actually an initiative that our city, New York City, has already, they actually planned it. They're moving it forward. They moved it forward. But they were going to move it forward without standards. Now, Fresh is, it stands for food, retail, but it's a very long name, forgive me. But it's actually about getting supermarkets into areas of the city that are under-resourced. Because in certain areas of our cities, there are things called food deserts. Literally, food deserts, where it's nearly impossible to find healthy food that is affordable within walking distance. And the city has identified five major neighborhoods in the city, swaths of territory, where that is true. Harlem being one of them, South Bronx being another, East New York being another, Central Brooklyn, and then parts of Queens. These areas have been identified by the city to receive a pilot program called the Fresh Program, where the city will incentivize supermarkets to come and move into these neighborhoods. The problem was, in the city's plan, they did not mandate that supermarkets getting these incentives actually served fresh food. They also did not demand that supermarkets moving into these neighborhoods hired people from the neighborhood. So it was highly possible, and you know how this happens, a good supermarket would move into a poor neighborhood and it would be a trigger for gentrification in that neighborhood. And they would not be, they'd be basically priced out of the only good food in their neighborhood. So we mounted a campaign over the course of the last year where we were talking with city council people, talking with the city planning office, and New York Faith and Justice and the Faith Leaders for Environmental Justice joined a coalition that was actually not led by us. It was led by the Food and Food and Commercial Workers Union, United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1500. Because they are the ones who are most organized, and they really represent the workers, they represent the poor. So we were really just coming in partnership. They know what they need. We're there to leverage our influence on behalf of and in partnership with them. So we showed up along with them to a city council meeting where we gave testimony. And I want to read to you the testimony that we gave so that you can understand what the power of the faith voice is in organizing for environmental justice. Testimony of Lisa Sharon Harper. Honorable City Council members, thank you for this opportunity to address the Zoning and Franchises Subcommittee today regarding the city's proposed FRESH program. My name is Lisa Sharon Harper. I'm the co-founder and executive director of New York Faith and Justice, blah, blah, blah. On November 5th, 1984, our city passed a law with the best of intentions. Local Law 71 created the Industrial and Commercial Incentive Program, ICIP, now the Industrial Commercial Abatement Program, ICAP. Among the many intended benefits of ICIP, now the was the creation of jobs in low-income areas, as the law paved the way for chain stores to enter under-resourced neighborhoods. Fast food establishments took advantage of this program and now lined the corridors of low-income communities. Supermarkets were not eligible. In 1984, City Council had good intentions, but history has revealed a plethora of problems in its wake. The council provided jobs, but demonstrated no concern for these communities' access to healthy food. The result, 40% of new cases of type 2 diabetes, cases in Central and East Harlem, are children, according to a recent report by the New York City Department of Health and Hygiene. Now note, type 2 diabetes usually occurs in adults 40 years and older. 61% of people in under-resourced neighborhoods are obese. Fast food establishments and pharmacies now line the streets of poor areas while supermarkets are closing. What's worse, the ICAP strategy only brought a marginal number of good jobs to targeted neighborhoods. Now, the current economic downturn is exacerbating the unemployment disparity between Black and white New Yorkers. According to a July 12, 2009 report by the New York Times, job losses show wider racial gap in New York. The unemployment rate among Blacks is rising four times faster than among whites in our city. Who is being hit the hardest? The residents of neighborhoods targeted by the FRESH program. Consider this. In a September 23, 2009, New York Times report, a plan to add supermarkets to poor areas with healthy results, Whole Foods executive Christina Minardi voiced interest in the FRESH program. She said, "It's definitely enticing for us." Now I ask you, without good jobs guaranteed, will the residents of FRESH program neighborhoods really have access to the high-priced fruit and vegetables offered by stores like Whole Foods? Most likely they will not. With no job standards attached to the FRESH program, there's no guarantee these stores will hire from the community. There's also no assurance that unscrupulous stores will not take advantage of FRESH communities by targeting residents for low-wage jobs. The 1984 City Council passed policy that provided jobs without good food. History is revealing the repercussions of their vote. Today, this council considers another proposal with good intentions. This time it offers food with no guarantee of good jobs. The members and organizational partners of New York Faith and Justice urge you not to make the same mistake as your predecessors. Not now, not when the cost would be so real, so quick, and so dire for people already hurting so much. Good food without good jobs is not enough. At best, it's charity. At worst, it's a tease and a Trojan horse for accelerated gentrification and the displacement of the most vulnerable New Yorkers. With the real threat of gentrification bearing down on fresh target communities, the council must go beyond charity. You have an opportunity today. Supermarkets naturally employ large members of staff. Good food with good jobs attached can empower more people in fresh target communities and lay the groundwork for a transformational kind of development, the kind that stabilizes at-risk communities from the inside out. Mahatma Gandhi said, a society's greatness is measured by how it treats its weakest members. Cardinal Roger Mahoney echoed Gandhi and Jesus. Any society is judged on the basis of how it treats its weakest members, the last, the least, and the littlest. History will look back on this city council. She will judge you not by your good intentions, but by the effect of your policies on the last, the least, and the littlest in our city. The 1984 council had its watch. This is your watch. Take this opportunity to make things right. We are praying for you, and we are watching. In the council chamber, as soon as we finished, the council chamber erupted in applause. Why? Because we had had a succession of people who gave testimony about the facts, but the voice of the faith community added a higher level of accountability to the issue. And the council itself began to realize this is larger than we thought. And ultimately, we got what we asked for. The fresh program passed with standards attached and also with different measures attached that will assure that good jobs do come with these fresh programs into the neighborhood.
So as Lisa and the New York Faith and Justice Network was organizing in their community, another community of Christians was also taking up the work of environmental justice in our community. And in some ways, unplanned in terms of our coordination, but we've learned a lot from each other as we've done this work. The journey for Boston into environmental justice started a little bit differently. In Boston, the group is largely lay members of churches, members of fellowships, campus fellowships, graduate fellowships, and young adults. And in 2006, 2007, this group began to just meet in homes and organize house meetings where we asked each other, where do you feel the call of justice on your heart? Where is God moving in your life? And what pains you? And the piece that emerged from that that conversation and a whole series of conversations that happened around the city was a sense of real unease in the disjunct between our lives as Americans and those of our brothers and sisters around the world. So we asked, based on the New Testament story, where are the Lazaruses at our gates? Almost all of us in the developed world, in the United States, are the rich man in the story, in the story that Jesus tells in Luke, and at all of our gates are many millions of Lazaruses who are, who feed on just a tiny portion of what we have. We looked at the fact that the richest 10% account for 85% of the world's assets. And 20% of the world's people, we're part of that 20%, account for 86% of total consumption, with the poorest 20% accounting for less than 2%. And as we dug deeper, we became even further aware of the tension between modern consumerism and this picture of global injustice. We realize that we buy a lot of stuff. And we buy a lot of stuff that's implicated in the suffering of others. And this suffering relates not just to people, but also their relationship with their environment. So in New York, where the question of environmental justice came from looking at, well, who ends up with the trash that's created in our society? Well, our question about environmental justice came when we realized, well, who pays for the production of all the stuff that we buy and consume? So one example is produce. Some portion of produce can be grown locally, as many of you know, and have probably begun to think about switching to buying locally, but some of it is not. And so we think about bananas, which are largely grown in Central America. So every time we eat a banana, it also costs something to grow that. And it costs something to the environment. What are some examples that you could imagine of the environmental impact of producing things like food? I'm sure some of you know. What's that? So there's clearing of land to grow food. Soil erosion, which also is kind of linked to the deforestation. Pesticides and chemicals are huge.
A loss of the biological diversity.
Exactly. So many of these can be seen actually in the story of bananas. So a good portion of the land in Central America was deforested to cultivate bananas. This is in the early 1900s. Such that now there's a real lack of biodiversity there, and in fact there's only one strain of banana that's grown, which then leads to a bunch of other problems in terms of the plants and animals that would grow up around those plants. Probably the biggest problem, the immediate problem, is the use of pesticides. So in a typical plantation, pesticides are applied from a plane, and they're just dropped onto the whole field, resulting in a great deal of health problems for workers. Many workers whose bananas were ultimately sold to Dole eventually sued the company for becoming sterile because of the exposure to pesticides. In other regions where things like cocoa and coffee are grown, there's a great deal of deforestation so that more and more plants, more and more cocoa and coffee producing plants can be planted, and a lack of reusing the soil, right? But this is also linked not just to kind of the environment, as Lisa is saying, it's not just sort of the environment as a separate thing, but it's a relationship between the environment and people. And in particular, a relationship between the use of the environment and poverty. A couple of examples. Because of low wages, because of the need of families, many of those same workers in Central America who work the fields, who are exposed to pesticides, are children. And in Africa, where cocoa is a major product and a major crop, the low price of cocoa is part of what forces families to then deforest more and more land to grow cocoa, and it ends up being a cycle, in part because of the very low wages, the very low access to assets and self-determination for families. So it's really linked together, environment and human livelihood. These were some of the questions that came up when we think about what it is we buy and what it would be that Jesus would buy. But I also want to think about the other side. I mean, just as there is a theology of shalom, which draws us into God's plan of making things right, of being part of that that work of justice, we also believe that there's a theology of gratitude that attends our work for environmental justice. And it starts with a simple thing. It starts with the recognition and the remembrance that creation itself is a blessing, that what we have is to be shared by all. It's a blessing, not not something that's given to us just for our own purposes, just for our own good, but it's intended to be shared by all. And so when we remember that, when we remember that it is in fact God who is blessing us, God who is providing, we begin to think differently about what it is we need and think we need. Boston, for this, our experience with this actually started after first sort of discerning, we were called to look at the nexus between our consumption and its impact on other people. We participated in a series of small group Bible studies. We called them economic discipleship groups. And small groups participated in this for about a year, where we looked at that theology of gratitude, that biblical vision of God's creation and what it means for our lives, and then simultaneously explored what it is that our actual budgets, our actual food cabinets. We looked at those and in small groups invited and challenged each other to make simple changes, to use less and to switch ways that we were consuming that were not beneficial to other people. Through that process over 150 people participated in a small group, made a commitment to simplified living and just consumption, and then began to meet in teams in their church to think, well, how do we continue to support each other, but also change our whole community so that this kind of living, this kind of vision is not something that is just shared by us, but can be available and more widely practiced. So here's where we began to look at fair trade. Who is familiar with fair trade? Okay. Give me a one sentence definition of fair trade. Giving farmers a fair share. Inclusive of many other factors going into use, like meaning production?
Yeah, or families,
their schools. Yes. Those are exactly. Those are both great definitions of fair trade. So fair trade is basically a way of stopping that, addressing part of the root cause of environmental degradation, which is poverty, and also lack of control and ownership that low-income families and communities often have that push them to a place where either they're working a plantation that they don't own and can't control the kind of pesticides and products that are used, or are so poor that they feel pressured to continue to, strip the land, use practices that are maybe a short-term benefit but aren't a long-term good. Fair trade tries to stop that at that point of restoring some dignity and control to workers. And so there's a commitment to workers who participate in the fair trade system to receive a fair price for their goods, to link consumers more directly with producers. So there are fewer middlemen who take a share of the price before it gets to reach our market. There are also requirements related to respect for the environment, including limits on the kind of pesticides and other chemicals that can be used, and a guarantee that farmers have safe and fair working conditions. And so here's an example. There are fair trade banana cooperatives in Ecuador where workers not only receive a fair price, have a protection from pesticides and other products that damage both them and their environment, but also receive a social premium, as this gentleman said, that they can use to invest back in their community. And very often that is used, it can be used for something like a school or a health clinic, but it can also be used to improve their farming techniques so they can move up to an organic standard, or they can improve the rotation of their crops so as to preserve soil. So having that bit more of asset and ownership of the process means that people can invest in a safer way. And so we took this to the streets, quite literally in Boston, and with the goal of making Boston a fair trade town where fair trade products were widely available. We actually had some numbers, some targets of the number of stores, institutions, and churches that we want to see carrying fair trade. So teams of people who are part of the church network in BFJN, Boston Faith and Justice, each came up with a strategy for how they would do it. These are folks from Hope Church who decided to sell fair trade chocolate at their local farmers market while also inviting people to sign up around fair trade. And incidentally, we're able to invite a fair number of people to join them at church as well, because people were like, what are you doing here? Well, we're talking about fair trade, but we're from Hope Church.
That's cool.
We did store surveys, and this is actually with a youth group, a summer program youth group, where the youth actually practiced they surveyed stores in their neighborhood to ask them if they were or weren't carrying fair trade and to invite them to carry more fair trade products. And so we practiced in advance. They went out for an evening and did surveys, and we came back and regrouped to figure out how to reach those stores that looked like they had an interest in carrying fair trade. And then we had churches, again, those same groups that started as Bible study groups began to work in their own churches to invite them to go fair trade. So this is the Boston Vineyard Church, which has gone fair trade, and this is their inaugural Fair Trade Sunday. So what we see and are excited about in fair trade is that there are ways to make local changes that have a global impact. That the fact that we are related to people globally does not have to mean that we gather the benefit and others bear the burden of our consumption. But in fact, it can be a way for us to build partnerships and serve with one another.
So when we're looking at organizing for environmental justice, we are looking to find the spiritual heart of environmental injustice in our communities and the sphere of influence within which we can actually make an impact. And we want to find community partners. I think in both of our stories, what you saw is that there are community partners that we accessed, that we partnered with, who actually said, you know what? In fact, most of the times they came to us and said, you know what? We really need the faith voice in this in order to take it to the next level. Would you please partner with us? And that's what we did. And we wanted to, and we needed to envision an alternate world, a world that is actually not as it is. I loved actually the talk last night on prayer and how the prayer, you know, was it the prayer, the intercessors will own history. Because really, people who are praying, they receive visions of what's possible. And so I think that for those who are organizing for environmental justice, you need to have a picture of what justice would look like. What would it look like to make things right in our city, in our neighborhood, in our world? And then finally, developing an inspiring and an achievable neighborhood, city, or regional goal, and identify what part each person or church or organization can play to achieve that vision. Our vision, overarching vision, is a broad awareness of the connection between consumption and justice among Christians in Greater Boston, and for us, it's people of faith in New York City, and the capacity to hold institutions accountable for humane and sustainable production. And in New York City, it's the capacity for our city to actually create a just and sustainable system, a food system for New York City, a just and sustainable toxic waste system in New York City, a just and sustainable climate regulating system in New York City. And finally, for us, you know, we go back to the picture of shalom. I think a beautiful picture of shalom is given to us in Psalm 85. This is a painting that was painted by John August Swanson, an artist out of Los Angeles. And Psalm 85, basically what it tells us is that mercy and truth will meet in the middle. Justice and shalom will kiss. Truth is going to spring up from the ground, and equity will look down from the skies, and God will make the land fruitful again. No longer are we going to have these thorns and thistles. No longer are we going to have animals sniping. Because guess what? Our relationship with God will be well. And why will it be well? Because we will be choosing all, the peace of all, rather than just the peace of ourselves. And as we choose the peace of all, we're going to be making choices about our environment that bless all, not just blessing ourselves at the expense of others. And as God takes steps on the land, Psalm 85 says, things will be made right again. So that's what we have to offer in terms of two case studies of what it looks like to organize faith communities for environmental justice. I think what we would like to do now is we'd like to break you into groups. If you could get into groups of four or five, just where you are. And there's about, you know, we can do that. And then take about 5 minutes. What we'd like for you to do is to ask yourself one of three questions. The first question is, where do you fall into this picture? Where do you see yourself actually grabbing hold, latching onto this picture, and walking forward with it in your community? How can your community begin to organize for faith and for environmental justice? Second question is, how? You saw two different methodologies here. What are the things that you liked about the methodologies that you saw that you think would be transferable to your context? What are the things that maybe won't work, you know, that in your context they probably wouldn't work, right? And then the third question is, how are you going to communicate this back to your community? Maybe we'll give you 10 minutes instead of five. Okay? So thank you. Go into your groups and we'll call you back in 10 minutes. Go. Okay, let's come back together. Let's come back together, and I'd like for us to share around those three questions that I asked earlier. The three questions, just for reminder's sake, is where do we fit? Where do you find yourself fitting into this environmental justice story? Can you see yourself actually engaging in environmental justice in your community, your city, in our world? Secondly, what methodologies that you saw here connect with you and your context? And then third, how are you going to communicate this back to your community? So anything, any one of these, if one of them really, you know, is the thing that really you talked about most in your circle, that's fine. You don't have to answer all three. Just go for it whenever you feel like you want to answer. Who would like to talk first?
Hi. I was talking with them, and I definitely see myself going back to my hometown and going to the church and working with them, and mostly with younger kids like 7th and 8th graders, and being a minister, and as also incorporating environmental justice in their, you know, curriculum or whatever they're learning at the time, so that they can be aware of the issues, not only, you know, at school, because you learn that too, but also on a, you know, a faith base too.
And you might actually want to get in contact with them and ask them if they do a toxic tour in your city. I know in New York City, I know in Newark there is this, and I know all around, or in Boston there is. You can actually ask environmental justice agencies to give you a tour of the most toxic areas of the city, and that's a great way to help this issue, or this help it to be transformed from becoming an issue to becoming a heart thing that people, it's a part of their heartbeat. It's great. Others?
I see myself bringing environmental justice into the classroom, and I was actually watching this movie in my environmental studies class, and it was talking about having kids from urban schools go and spend the night in a park and just really learn about the impacts of how the environment applies to them within the urban setting. Because I think so often, even myself, you just think of environment as nature and whatnot, but kind of, you know, how, you know, the whole the whole Fresh initiative and how why aren't grocery stores, why am I not getting healthy food on my plate, and why is my grandma having health problems, and you know, why is the runoff, you know, on the streets? And so I really feel like that's where God's calling me. And within California, they have this thing, I don't know if you've heard about it, but literacy for ecological literacy, and they have a lot of organizations around there. So I just want to thank you ladies for just being such an inspiration, because I think that I can really hook up with these organizations, and they already have a big youth following in the city, but just how to like combine my faith into that. So I want to thank you again.
First of all, when you said Fresh, all of a sudden it just triggered what Fresh means for me. I remembered it, not for me, but what it means. It means food retail expansion to support health. That's the name of the program in New York City, and so the acronym is Fresh. But then the second thing is that in California, you might really want to check out a group called CLU, Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, and they actually work with supermarket workers. They work with, they're really more focused on unions and helping labor unions to move forward, but oftentimes those labor unions, especially in California, are connected to the food industry and connected to environmental justice for the poor, connected to the food industry. So I would really encourage that. Yeah. How about others? Okay.
I guess I would see myself coming from a mostly predominantly white suburban area, and the landscaping opportunities and things like that is just very scenic. So convincing what you were talking about, the link from buying power to the people, even though it's so separated, like where I am is like in the discussion in that setting to try to convince that, and sometimes it's like puking out so much of this conversation and I need to harness it better. But what I'm looking for more is a way to rethink the pristine areas, rural settings, and be able to represent them into the urban setting, not in terms of imbalances, but something that is still applicable to inner city as well.
I don't want to have a comment for everything, but I do have a thought about that. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that when we talk about the environment, we often are thinking, when we think environment, we think green, and we think grass, and we think trees, right? But you mentioned this as well, the woman who just spoke. The reality for the urban environment is that when we're talking about environment, we're talking about all those things that live, that we live around, that make up our landscape, the urban landscape. So when we talk about environmental justice, we're talking about the landscape. Part of that landscape is the transportation system. Part of that landscape is the school system. For example, one of the things we're working on right now is getting toxic caulk out of schools, or getting the city to really remediate the land where they're going to build a school, but there's actually toxins in that land. But believe it or not, they're actually trying to continue to build on that land. Because they can, unless the neighborhood stands up and says, not on our watch, you're not gonna have our kids up in that school, right? So the environment, the urban environment, the urban landscape includes much more than greenery. That's good.
I don't know if this is what you're thinking, but something that is also important when you're kind of thinking about the suburban environment is a great deal of what appears very healthy in that environment, like big green lawns and landscaped spaces, requires a lot of resources and a lot of chemicals. So it's sort of turning around this picture that we think is just perfect and actually helping us to recognize what the cost actually is, because often those who are enjoying that environment don't experience the cost.
That's interesting. How about that last question? How are you going to communicate this back to your community? Or did we get to the methodologies? Were there particular methodologies that really connected to you and your community that you could actually see yourself doing, engaging in? Does that make sense to folks? So for New York Faith and Justice, our methodology was to organize faith leaders in particular to educate them about what environmental justice is. So the methodology is bridging faith communities with environmental justice agencies, right, and also government agencies, so we can all walk together to leverage our collective influence on behalf of particular issues and neighborhoods experiencing environmental injustice in our city. That's one. The other was Boston Faith and Justice, which really worked through small groups, building small group support for living simply in order to address a specific issue that actually has local, we have to act locally in order to make a global impact. So those were the two in general that we looked at. Where do you think you can actually begin? What do you think is actually something that's doable for you and your community? We're interested to hear this. Okay.
I would just say that I figured the small group support for living simply and justly, mostly because I think when you get something that's local and everyone can see or that they're experiencing in your community or wherever you're living, they'll work together a little better, and more ideas will come up because they're affected no matter what it is. And I think that they'll help get the message out and also get more support when you have a lot of people involved and that are, you know, feeling the same thing or experiencing the same issues. Maybe, you know, water is like tastes bad, and you realize that water tastes bad because of something that's in the sewer system or whatever. So when you get everyone involved or at a local level, I think that'll bring, I don't know, a tight-knit community and more work that will get done. So.
And there's lots of ways to do small groups, right? Like you can do Bible studies, you can also do information gathering sessions, or prayer circles around the issue, that kind of thing. I think we want to move now into a section of just Q&A. If you have general questions about environmental justice or organizing for environmental justice, this is the time now. We have about 15 minutes left in our time. If you'd like to ask any general questions, go for it.
Speak about the local communities, but when you put the little co-op and things like that, do you have experience or any ideas of how the resources from local communities combine with the things across the world? So it's not a local economy is collecting the trade economy.
Certainly, from a broad perspective, there should be no conflict. You know, most fair trade products are things that really could not be grown in the United States. Bananas, coffee, chocolate, spices, rice, sugar. So we use all these products. It's pretty unlikely even the most ardent local food advocate would give up sugar, you know. So you know, for the first is just to see them as not in conflict, as really complementary ways to support, you know, just and sustainable farming practices. On a more practical level, you know, one thing our group did was, you know, collaborate with their local farmers market to have a fair trade booth at the farmers market. And so then people had the option to learn about both. They could talk to people, and for the most part, people shared similar values. I think there are a number of kind of growing networks that really more intentionally try to practice the same practices in local and international markets. An Equal Exchange, for example, is one. They do have some domestic projects, so they're supporting lower income farmers in the United States as well as internationally. And I think there's a growing number of those as well.
In New York City, there's been a really interesting, like, ballooning of interest what would it look like to create a just and sustainable food system, right? So a just food system makes sure that everyone has fresh food, make sure that farmers are well paid and supported and they're not going under, and make sure that workers on farms are well paid and supported, whether they're small farms or large farms. It also, a sustainable system is going to make sure that the production of food and the waste management of food doesn't overextend the resources that we have in the production and in the waste management, and that all of that happens in a way that is just, right? So we're not dumping all of our trash onto the South Bronx and other neighborhoods like that. So actually, I want to tell you one place you can go to take a look at, like, New York Faith and Justice was a part of a steering committee convened by the Manhattan Borough President. And we are not, by far, we are not the only city in the world that has done this, but over the last year, we've actually been working towards putting together a food charter for New York City. And so we followed the model of several different cities, including London and Philadelphia and Toronto and others who have gone before us and put together a food charter. But for our city, really what we need is we want something that is going to create a system. Right now, New York has Plan NYC, which is really to have a sustainable city by the year 2030. But in Plan NYC takes care of every kind of system in New York except food. Food is left out. And so that's one of the reasons why we have a food charter now, in order to press the city council to move food into Plan NYC, or to create another plan that includes food. So if you go on to our website at nyfaithjustice.org, you'll actually see a link to the food charter, and you can click on that and you can actually sign the pledge. There's a pledge and there's a food charter that you can actually see. This is what it would look like. What we discerned, along with about 20 other interest groups in New York City over the course of a year, that this is what a just and sustainable food system would look like. And what, now, to answer your question about the locally grown food, there's something in New York City that's being developed called a food shed. And what that looks like is looking at all of the different local resources that we have. For example, in New York State, New York State produces, I think, the most apples of any state in the country, and yet we buy all of our apples from Washington. We don't get our apples in New York City from New York State. We would save so much money in production and have such a much more sustainable system if we actually regulated where our apples came from and bought from local farms, at least from something within the 100 mile radius of the city. But we haven't done that because we haven't thought about that until just now. So that's part of what it would look like to have a sustainable system. But part of also what it looks like is to support fair trade around the world. So we don't want to put, you know, farmers out of work in Fiji or someplace else. So it's not that we're fighting for 100% locally grown food, but that some just proportion and sustainable proportion of our food would come from local farmers. Question. What I would recommend is that you go online and Google that toxic waste and race paper that was written. Make sure that you get both. I think it was written in 1985, and they just did an update of it recently. I think it was 2000 or 2006 they did an update. And the sad thing is that after all of those years, I think it was must have been 2005, after 20 years, they realized there's no change. No change at all in that map that overlays the different dots, right? The toxic dots with the black and Latino dots. It's the same one-to-one correlation. In terms of movies, I think there's some pretty good movies out right now, documentaries that really document the problem. Food Inc. is a really great one that's been recommended to me a lot by a lot of different people. Definitely Super Size Me, because you begin to understand, if you look at that, you'll see the question of fast food restaurants and how, like, if you walk down 125th Street in Harlem, all you see is fast food restaurants. When you look at Super Size Me, you'll understand why 60 to 80% of the people in Harlem are obese. And then you have all of the issues that come along with that, diabetes and the rest. If you have other resources.
Well, I was going to say, I've worked on food issues and food security in a couple different cities, and in all of those, there was a local university who probably did the best, you know, mapping of, you know, what are in Massachusetts. There's an excellent map in terms of brownfields and the state landscape. So, you know, where is there a concentration of waste, and how does that overlay with demographic data? You know, and you can see very clearly that there's a strong correlation between communities of color and waste. So that was, I think, Northeastern University for Massachusetts. And in Delaware, it was the University of Delaware was doing most of the research about food access. So I think often it's those places that have really accurate local data.
That's great. I mean, I wish I had other resources to offer you right now.
That's a problem. That's a good point.
There are. I mean, they actually are out there, but most of them are going to be academic books that, you know, that have been written more for the classroom. But what I would also recommend is just look at that toxic waste and race paper, especially the 2005 one, because that'll have updated bibliography, right? So you can take a look at. That's the one from the UCC, United Church of Christ. Other questions?
And actually, I should say the National Council of Churches has an eco-justice program, which is probably building on some of that research.
Yeah. Any other questions?
All these methodologies.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I would say, I mean, for us, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in New York City is actually an organizational partner of New York Faith and Justice, right? So they come and they come to the Faith Leaders for Environmental Justice meetings, and they might send a student or they might have a staff worker there, but they're aware, and in that way they can actually mobilize their students to go and sign the pledge, right? To go and maybe pass around leaflets on campus to let people know about environmental justice. I think what it really takes is it takes being connected in with the groups, particularly from the neighborhoods that are affected, so that you can partner with them. That's the main principle for us in New York City in that particular methodology, is that we're not trying to lead anything. We're trying to learn and leverage our influence in partnership with the communities that are most affected. And all that really takes is relationship building. Now, what I love about what Boston did is they're trying to learn and leverage their resources on behalf of and in partnership with communities around the world. And they have a particular methodology. So the small group is also extremely effective for universities. And so having small group Bible studies about environmental justice, or prayer groups about it, or gatherings around a movie that would be able to take a look and then ask questions afterwards. But the most important thing is that you don't stop at the learning piece. You must, after you learn, now you are accountable for what you know. And you are not a friend to these neighborhoods. You are not a friend to the workers who are not being treated fairly if all you do is you learn about it and then go to Starbucks, right? You are a friend to these neighborhoods, to these communities, if you learn about it and then get active. You know, even just calling them up and saying, I learned about this, what can I do? That would be a great first start.
I actually envy that you're on a college campus, because there are a lot of great things that you can do there. I will say, I don't think there would be a fair trade presence in the United States if it weren't for students. In the late 90s, early 2000s, students, at least in the universities around where I was in Boston, started organizing to get their student cafeterias to carry fair trade. Now they're also often working to get local food and healthier food in the cafeterias. I mean, there's sort of some justice issues because students at Harvard get better food, and then great, you know, but it does mean a better food production system, especially around fair trade. So there's a lot of things you can do on your campus to say, okay, how is our cafeteria operating? Now how is our dorm operating? Where do you go to school?
We're at a university in Salem, Oregon.
Oh, cool, okay. Mm. I'm trying to think of who to, I mean, two schools that I know of that I think do this well are, I'm thinking of both Christian colleges, Eastern University and Gordon College. Both of it. Is there a Gordon College person here? Yeah, the students have done really amazing work getting improved, you know, sustainability standards and food. So I would kind of look and see what their student groups are doing and see how you could translate that.
We're done, aren't we?
Thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate you coming out and listening to us today. And if you have any questions, please feel free to come up and we'll, you know, we'd love to talk with you. And also you can check out our websites, Boston Faith and Justice Network, Google it, or New York Faith and Justice. Thanks so much for coming.